one kicking things out of orbit.
Oh my gosh!
I'm gonna just knock it forward.
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much now.
Khabib gets his hands on McGregor gonna be that night.
Let's get into it.
Hello! You are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC 257, Poirier versus McGregor 2. I will do all of this with one half of the Fight Night Picks preview show. I'm speaking, of course, with the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. What a night of fights. It was just a crazy night. Like, you know, it's a really big fight night when you start getting texts from people that you know nothing about MMA and know nothing about the UFC. You just start getting a lot of those questions like, oh, Conor's fighting tonight. Who's he fighting? And then you have to explain who Dustin Poirier is to these people. After last night, though, I'm pretty sure they're all well aware of who he is.
I agree. All right, let's get into it, Matt. Conor fights nowadays are like Christmas, not because of how great they are, but we only get them once a year. However, with that being said, he's still a massive star, and any fight he is in is going to draw a lot of eyes. So we'll get to Conor in a second, but first let's take a quick look at the rest of the card. When you saw this card, how excited were you? Because I got to be honest, when I really gave it a good look, there was a lot more to this card than I actually thought there would be on a Conor card. So what'd you think going in?
I agree. There was a few fights that did fall out. I know we normally go over these, but that Shane Burgos-Hakeem Dawodu fight, I was really excited for. Shane Burgos, if you like MMA boxing, you like Shane Burgos. And Hakeem Dawodu, again, Canadian, got to shout him out. Phenomenal Muay Thai fighter. That would have just been a really, really fun fight. That's one of those like main card opener fights that you just know is going to deliver, kind of get the hype trending for the rest of the evening. But listen, we got a great fight card altogether. Just the fact that we had Michael Chandler's debut on a Conor McGregor card. Craig and I are big on letter grades. That boosted up to basically an A no matter what. But I thought for what we got and kind of the name value on this card, it really did deliver.
I agree. Let's get to that main event, Matt. The last time Conor McGregor fought Dustin Poirier, Joe Biden was vice president. Donald Trump was in between seasons of The Celebrity Apprentice. So a lot has changed since then. Particularly for these two fighters, Conor had not yet won a title in the UFC, was not yet a father, and was not a global superstar. Dustin Poirier had some fights against big names, but was far from establishing his name. He was closer to the quiet hillbilly from the back ass of nowhere that Conor McGregor called him the first time around than he is today. For some fun, let's take a look at the rest of this card just to give it rest of the card the first time they fought. Just to give it some context as to how much time has passed. The main event was a Demetrius Johnson title defense. This was the night of Stoolgate with Tim Kennedy and Yoel Romero. Kat Zingano beat Amanda Nunes. Donald Cerrone beat Eddie Alvarez. And oh, by the way, Dominic Cruz, Jorge Masvidal, Stephen Thompson, and Kevin Lee were all on the prelims. So a lot has changed, suffice to say. All right, Matt. Let's get to the fight. Conor came out and did what Conor does. He stalked Poirier, looked for the big left. He had some good right hands early. He threw a couple of lefts. Poirier withstood them. And then he started to put his attention towards Conor's calves. Conor caught a couple, but, you know, the damage was done. Then Poirier brought out the boxing and turned out the lights. That's a short recap. That's what I saw, Matt. What'd you see?
Okay, this fight was really, really technical, and everyone just focused on the calf kicks of Dustin Poirier. Like, that was the conversation on Twitter. That was the conversation really in the commentary. I don't think we give Dustin Poirier enough credit for his counter-striking against a counter-striker in Conor McGregor. And listen, I'm a massive Dustin Poirier fan. I'm probably too big of a fan of his. But even I was a little bit nervous on the feet because McGregor was landing, and he was landing hard shots too. Like, it's not like Dustin Poirier went out there and beat, like, an unmotivated Conor McGregor. I don't really think you can point to that and be like, oh, well, it wasn't McGregor's best night. Because then that first round, he looked phenomenal. And I think I'm going to take you through like almost like the JFK assassination. So about a minute and 10 seconds left in the first round, Conor McGregor lands his best strike possible. He lands a perfectly extended, straight, clean left straight on the chin of Dustin Poirier. And it cracks him. Like, it hits him really hard. And Poirier, he just eats it. He takes about a step back. And right at that very moment, that's when Conor tried to do that little duck to the right, kind of right shovel hook, if you will, that he was landing quite a bit. But that's when Poirier caught him with that check right hook. And that check right hook really was the story of the night, because from that moment on, he hits him with it the first time. And you could tell Poirier points at him with one hand, kind of gives him a nod like, oh, you didn't think I could do this, and this is going to be open all night long. And I think just that little 20-second interval of, I ate your best shot, and I found my counter immediately, that gives you all the confidence in the world. And I thought Daniel Cormier did a great job in the commentary booth, especially for this fight. And I love Paul Felder, but everything Paul Felder said had to do with McGregor. It was always McGregor did something well or McGregor did something negatively, whereas Daniel Cormier was actually giving Poirier credit for some of the things that he was able to do. And when he was starting to land that boxing, and the great quote by Daniel Cormier is, Dustin Poirier is like an avalanche. Once he gets going, there's really nothing you can do to stop him. And we did see that in the second round, because again, it was set up by the calf kicks, but the real finish came from that check right hook. He lands that nice calf kick, darts off to the right, hits him with a check right hook. And I think that was the first shot that really hurt McGregor. And they didn't show it on the replay. They just kind of showed the flurry up against the cage. But if you go back, it's all over Twitter today. Those right hooks land over and over and over again. And when you have a guy like McGregor who does utilize his movement so much, especially that in and out kind of darting movement that he has, almost like that point karate style, when you do start to compromise that leg, he is going to become more hittable as the fight goes on. And Poirier, he huffs and puffs from the second the fight starts. And when Craig and I were doing the fight companion, there were a lot of people after the first round who were like, Poirier's done. He looks tired. But your boy over here, a seasoned Dustin Poirier watcher, was like, no. He huffs and puffs from the second the fight starts until it ends. He still has very good cardio. And as the fight progressed, you could see the confidence growing of Poirier. I really do think you could. And as that second round was going forward, he was able to eat the best shots that Conor gave him. And when Poirier started to actually let his hands go and not just look for the counter, it's not like he was landing massive shots by any means, but there was a little sequence where he goes for that check right hook. He doesn't catch him really clean with it, but he does hit McGregor with it. He sort of acknowledges it. Same thing, sort of gives McGregor like a nod. And then McGregor just, I don't know if he didn't want to let his hands go as much because he was worried about the counters coming back, but that's when Poirier would do that little, like, it's very Nate Diaz-esque where he goes tap, 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 and then he'll throw a hard shot. He only was able to do that about two times before the actual finishing sequence of the fight. But when Poirier is doing that little, like, 1-2, 1-2, and then I'm going to whip that straight left in, he's a really hard fighter to deal with. So I think this fight 100% comes down to Dustin Poirier was just the better fighter last night. And I've seen, like, Chael Sonnen made a 16-minute video about this fight. So, of course, I'm going to watch it just to see what other people were thinking about it. And a lot of what he had to say was that, oh, I've never seen Conor so slow. I've never seen him look so bad. Like, Khabib, he was able to defend his takedown attempts, but Poirier was able to take him down fairly easily. Like, everything he was saying discredited what Dustin Poirier did. And I hate it when this happens when you have a really high-profile fight. We focus on the negatives of the more famous of the two. I know Conor, people are going to talk about him no matter what, but I think the conversation should be, Dustin Poirier is one of the greatest fighters at 155 pounds of all time. And I don't know what version of Conor McGregor would have been able to beat that version of Dustin Poirier, who he fought last night.
Yeah, so let's unpack this from a lot of different directions. So I agree with a lot of what you said. I think the interesting thing is that, you know, you can make an argument that Conor's a front runner. You can make an argument that, you know, he kind of gets this rap about being a quitter. Here's what I'll say about the quitter stuff. I don't 100%. And then listen, this wasn't an issue of being a quitter last night anyway, because he got knocked dead. But I think with me, the thing that I saw in the maturation of Dustin Poirier is that I thought, to be honest with you, going into this fight, like as he was walking to the cage and all that, he still looked a little shook, right? Like mentally, he seemed like the moment was pretty big. The difference is nowadays, even when the moment is too big, he still has great technique to fall back on. Whereas the first time he fought Conor, when the moment was too big, he was just overwhelmed. And before you know it, he was smothered. And, you know, on early stoppage on these shows, there's three or four guys I quote, Teddy Atlas, Chael Sonnen, and, you know, you guys, if you listen to these things, you know the cast of characters. So I'll talk about Teddy Atlas for this reason. And this works well for Dustin Poirier because Teddy and Dustin have a relationship. When Teddy Atlas was cornering Timothy Bradley, it's very famous. You can go to YouTube. He did the fireman speech, right? And the fireman speech is, you were forged in the fire. You practice in the fire. You've come of age in the fire. You're a fireman. You're comfortable in the flames. You're not scared of them. It's where you're at home is the gist of what he delivers it much better than I did, but it's the gist of it. And I think that the difference between when Poirier fought Conor last time and this time is that Poirier's been in those flames. He's went with Hooker. He's went with all these fights. He's been in all these firefights, so he's no longer intimidated by one. So when Conor cracks him, he can look at him. And I thought it was, you know, the comment I made when he did all that stuff where he was like pointing at Connor and smiling and all that was, I was like, he's already losing the mental game to Connor because, you know, he's doing it because he thinks that that's what you need to do against Connor. In retrospect, looking back on it now, it's just him being confident and saying, this is not going to be like the last time. And I think that that's the thing that I took most from Poirier in terms of like where he is now and where he is moving forward. I do push back a little bit to, would the best version of Conor McGregor have beaten last night's Dustin Poirier? Only in this respect. I do think Conor's looked better and been more prepared for fights. But the other part of it is that I think that what Dustin brought to the table would always be a problem for Conor because of his stance, because of his fighting style. I don't know that Conor would have I feel like earlier in his career, Conor switched stances more. That might have benefited him last night. I don't know. But listen, you have to take your hat off to Dustin Poirier because he's the one that's had the growth. And Conor McGregor was completely game. As game as he was for Cerrone, he went in there and, you know, absolutely ran through Cerrone. He tried to do the same thing to Poirier, and it didn't happen. So there's a new segment I want to try this week, and maybe we'll patch all these together for a piece of content. So we're going to call it 50, 5,000, and 50,000. So basically, I want you to look at both these fighters from 50 feet, which would be themselves, their own personal training, their gym. 5,000 feet's the division, and 50,000 feet's the UFC. So the easy way to do this, I think, would be to look at both fighters and say, should they be looking at their career from 50 feet, 5,000 feet, or 50,000? Meaning, do they need to get back to the drawing board at 50 feet and worry about their own training? Let's start with Dustin because he won. Do you think Dustin's eyes should be set on the division, on huge fights at 50,000 feet and what the UFC's up to? Or does he still have some things at 50 feet to worry about?
I think the reason he is where he is because he never looks past the 50 feet range. And that's what's so great about Dustin Poirier. Like, it doesn't matter who he's going to fight. You got to think, like, some of the guys who he has fought, he's fought Max Holloway twice. He's fought Conor McGregor twice, Eddie Alvarez twice, Justin Gaethje, Anthony Pettis. But he has had those losses to guys like Michael Chandler. He's had close fights. Even the one with Jim Miller was quite close. What I love about Dustin Poirier is that, yes, he does have these really big platforms, and especially nowadays and in this last little run that he's been able to go on. But the fact that, A, he is so involved in his community, and B, he's training at ATT. And here's the other thing, too. Mike Brown is coach of the year right now. And I know we're only like three events into the year. Mike Brown is an absolute genius. And I think Thiago Alves deserves a little bit of credit, too, because Conor McGregor said the first calf kick Dustin Poirier landed, Thiago Alves screamed, "Oh, that was a good one. You got him." And Conor in his head was like, "Ah, yeah, you're right. He really did get me well on that one." So just the fact that Thiago Alves is now in that coaching category, and we've talked about this before. I don't like it when coaches are those guys who, you know, they were undefeated. They were multiple time champions. Yes, it does work. But then you look at guys like the Mike Brown. Yes, he was champ, but he's had a lot of bad losses and his UFC career didn't really go all that well. But you just look at his skill set and what he has to offer from a coaching perspective and just sort of the mentality behind him as a coach. I think anyone at ATT who is closely associated with Mike Brown is going to go on and have a great career. But yeah, for Poirier, you're now the A side. Like, other people are looking for that fight with you. It's not like he can go out looking for a lot of big money fights because people are going to be now calling him out. Like, Charles Oliveira wants that fight now. Michael Chandler wants that fight now. If I'm Poirier, I just keep on going on. Like, I pay attention to my charity. I keep on training every single day. And the UFC has to come with you an offer, not the other way around.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing, too, if we're going to also add to that, listen, Thiago Alves, nobody kicked a leg harder ever than Thiago Alves used to. I mean, he was a killer. And you want to talk about big fights, he fought GSP at UFC 100. So, I mean, this kid, meaning, you know, Poirier's got a good brain trust around him. I mean, the kid's got a good head on his shoulders. He understands fighting. He seems to put himself in these places where he's in a position to absorb a lot of information. You know, I think he really, really enjoys the time that he spends talking to Teddy Atlas and taking from him. He has a great boxing coach. He has Mike Brown. He has Thiago Alves. I mean, he really surrounds himself with a lot of smart guys. So I'm with you. I think that he could do 50,000 feet where he starts booking like Nate Diaz or like these fights where he can make money. But I think, listen, I think 5,000 feet, it meaning the division, if Khabib's going to vacate that title, and listen, if you didn't see enough last night, Khabib, to come back, you're never coming back.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what you asked for. And you got it from the main and co-main. So if you didn't see enough last night in this little weird thing that you and Dana put out about if they show me enough, they both showed you enough. So if you're not coming back after that last night, you're not coming back. So for the lightweight vision. So I think, you know, listen, booking Chandler and Poirier off of last night makes a hell of a lot of sense. So I think he's at 5,000 feet. He's where he needs to be as a fighter. He shouldn't just start booking fights that the UFC wants. He should now solidify his legacy as a champion and move forward. Now for Conor, let's do the same thing. 50, 5,000, 50,000. I mean, he always has 50,000 options, right? Oh, yeah. He's going to, you know, he could start calling Floyd Mayweather's name. I wouldn't do this, but the Paul brothers are always there. He's got Nate. He's got, I mean, he has options. Conor's not without options. So, but then you can make a case that 50 feet, I mean, 5,000 is kind of out of the question right now. He's no longer really a player at 55. So do you think Conor should focus at 50 feet or 50,000?
It's really interesting. Here's the first thing. How sad would that be if his next fight is against one of the Paul brothers? Like, you go from being one of the best MMA fighters of your generation. Everyone knows who you are. You suffer one bad loss to one of the greatest fighters ever at that weight class. And now you're doing celebrity boxing. Like, that's not really how you like to see a guy's career trajectory go forward. It is interesting. Just bringing it back to McGregor and his camp. He said in training, he's never felt calf kicks before. Like, I'm not here to judge SPG. Again, they forgot more MMA than I'll ever know. But it's very odd that he wasn't prepared for the light kicks of Poirier. And I understand Poirier is not this vicious kicker by any means. It's interesting, too. Turns out if you have really invasive hip surgery, it helps you kick a lot. Because Poirier didn't really kick much, had that surgery. And you started to see his kicking game open up a little bit more in that Dan Hooker fight. He was throwing a lot of body kicks. And you could tell, like, Poirier, Mike Brown came out and said it. I think it was Mike Bonnet asked Dustin Poirier. They were like, why'd you go to the calf kick so much? Mike Brown had kind of heard it. He was off to the side. And he just yelled from behind, because he kicks really hard. And Dustin Poirier can kick with both legs. He has power in both hands. You would think if you're McGregor, you're prepared for all of that. And it's really interesting, too, because Poirier doesn't check leg kicks very well, but he throws them really well. So if you're Conor, why would you not expect to check a few leg kicks and retaliate with your own? Because, again, if you're not checking them and you're just eating damage to the leg, I understand McGregor threw a couple of them, but Poirier was outlanding him 5-6 really hard calf kicks to, like, the one leg kick that McGregor would throw. So if I'm McGregor, I would take a solid 6 months to just reconfigure my camp. And I'm not saying fire your coaches by any means. This is just one loss. And again, you lost to one of the better guys in the division. But I would just really try to fine tune what I'm going to do next. Like, am I going to be a boxer? Am I going to pursue a venture in boxing? Or am I going to be really dedicated to MMA? Because I think this fight showed that you can't really do both. Like, you need to be all in on one or the other. This is like Heather Hardy, but just at a way bigger scale. Heather Hardy, of course, she was the undefeated women's boxer. She had gone over to Bellator, and she was doing well against people who didn't really have high-level MMA experience. And then she fought one kickboxer and got absolutely dominated. So I do think you really have to go all in on one or the other, because there was talks, of course, McGregor fighting Pacquiao. And just there's, like you had said, there's always that sort of 50,000 range with McGregor. You always get your eyes set on those bigger and better things. But if I'm McGregor, I just wait. Like, his chin is something that he's been able to rely on because he is such a good striker. He's been able to eat shots, but eating shots at 155, especially against these guys at the top of the division, not who you really want to be testing your chin against. Like, if he fought Michael Chandler, and we're going to be talking about this after, the shot Chandler landed on Dan Hooker would knock out a horse, but Conor McGregor gets put down by that. He gets put down by clean shots. And if you're just going to be going in there trying to trade with these guys because you're so confident in your boxing, it's not going to work out well. So again, if I'm Conor, I just try to figure out, I would reevaluate this fight. I would talk to my coaches and say, okay, what did you guys see in this fight? Because I do think that there were adjustments to be made in between the first and second round. But as coaches, you can hear John Kavanaugh say, beautiful round. I just need you to keep the rear hand up, which didn't really make that big of a difference in the end. And that was all the advice that he offered. If I'm Mike, or if I'm John Kavanaugh, I'm saying start checking leg kicks. Start trying to counter off of those leg kicks. Make them pay for not throwing them, or for throwing them without setting them up by anything. There was just a lot of technical advice that I do think McGregor could have been giving in between rounds that it just wasn't there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with Conor and these, and where he's at. I mean, what he has is such, and listen, I'm going to say this name, and I don't want to do this because it's unfair to Conor, who's a two-weight champion, and he's done a lot of things. But, you know, thoughts of Ronda Rousey start to creep in the sense that, you know, what you were was this thing that no one could figure out. And then once they start to figure you out, it becomes a lot easier. So I guess my question moving forward for Conor is, how do you keep the best part? You can't completely redesign who you are as a fighter. So the question becomes, what do you do to handle these leg kicks, because that stance is probably what generates a lot of your power. So then the question is, and it, you know, it affords you some opportunities kicking wise and whatever it does, it's effective. So the question becomes, do you figure out a way to either check leg kicks better, or do you figure out a way to start switching stances when that comes? So now maybe you start to generate power in your opposite hand, and you, that's your, you know, your counter to it. Or do you, you know, what do you do with the wrestling? Because there's certain things where now Connor's starting to show these things where, you know, okay, if I go in there with this certain type of guy, this is what it is. Now, I think that Connor's aware of this, because my takeaway, and this could be me just reading something into something that isn't there. My takeaway, when he goes to the weigh-ins and tells Dustin Poirier, let's put on a show, right? Let's really give the fans something. I think that's code for let's slug it out, right? I do think that that's just me. And again, I could be reading something into this, but I think he knows that's where he's best is. And I listen, one other thing that I might say is that, you know, I think maybe Connor needs to, you know, Derek Jeter said once, I don't let negative talk come into my world. It's just not that's not how I work. So now, not allowing negative talk to come into your world and being self-assessing and reflecting on performances, there's a fine line there. I personally think that Connor took from some of Dan Hooker's success that, okay, this kid is predominantly a striker. He does a lot of the things that I do. Now, granted, the dimensions of Dan Hooker and his stance are different, but he said, if Hooker can hit this kid, then I can hit this kid, and if I hit him, I'll put him out. I don't think that he looked at the other parts of the game and didn't really notice, okay, why is Hooker getting hit? Poirier ultimately won this. You know what I mean? There's a lot of takeaways there. So I guess for me, in putting like a bow on this, is it as simple as, okay, Chandler for Poirier, and then what do you – or Oliveira. I mean, Poirier said in the post-fight, I think Oliveira deserves the shot. Because, you know, Poirier has all but crowned himself the 55-pound champ. What do you think's next for these two guys, like, so, specifically?
To piggyback off your previous point, I do agree with you on Conor McGregor does need sort of a more realistic self-assessment. What I don't like and what I've never liked is after every single one of his losses, you've got, oh, my foot was a balloon. Like, there's always a bit of an excuse that he can go back to. And, excuse me, I do think at a certain point, like, you can't really make an excuse for this loss. The whole buildup, you were saying, this is the best camp I've ever had. I was in Portugal for 10 weeks. Then I was in Ireland. Like, I fine-tuned a camp around me. I have more resources than anyone else in the sport has available. And I actually went out and used them all. He was talking about how perfect his camp went. You don't have an excuse now. You lost to another guy who does have a style very similar to yours. It's not like you lost to a wrestler and you could just be like, okay, well, I'm not really a grappler, so I'm going to lose to those guys. You finally did lose to a striker. And I do think he had not disdain for the striking of Dustin Poirier, but I do agree with you. I think he saw the Dan Hooker fight. He's seen some of Poirier's other fights. I'm sure the Gaethje won, even though Poirier did win. But he looks at a guy who is quite hittable. And I do think Conor McGregor didn't realize the power that was coming back his way, too. He was just happy to go in there and, well, I can land on him. I can land on him. I can land on him. He never really considered, oh, wait, I am still open for the counter shot. And it's weird, too, because, you know, we can talk about Poirier has some of the best boxing, really, in MMA. You don't see a lot of check hooks get land clean in really high-level MMA. It's not something that you see all that often. Like, a check hook's normally someone who isn't striking all that long. I go in for my combo. I stay there too long, and then you crack me with that check. Poirier was just able to land it over and over again because his timing is so good, and I don't think McGregor expected to be in there, at least not in MMA, with a striker who's that high-level, if that makes any sense. But I do agree. I know the UFC is going to want to do Chandler versus Poirier. It makes sense. A lot of eyes were on this card. Chandler looked phenomenal. There's a lot of hype behind him right now. Dustin Poirier, of course, is knocked out the biggest star in the sport. Charles Oliveira deserves the Dustin Poirier fight more than anyone else. He's on an 8-fight win streak in the UFC. He's finished pretty much all of it, or he's finished all of them. It's wild to see. He finished them all except for Ferguson. But what he's been able to do and the stamp he's been able to put on the division, and I like what Poirier said, Oliveira is a guy who he's been knocked down and he's come back and he's lost and he's come back and he's lost and he's come back and he looks better each and every time that he does come back. And I think this version of Charles Oliveira is, listen, he's a bad matchup for a lot of guys. Poirier is a really bad matchup for Oliveira, to be fair. But I think Oliveira deserves a little bit more than Chandler. I'd like to see them do Chandler versus Gaethje. That was a conversation that when Gaethje was originally a free agent after WSOF had got shut down, there was talks of Bellator trying to sign him to put together the Michael Chandler fight for their lightweight title. There's a bit of a storyline right there. You have two guys who were champs outside the UFC who aren't champs in the UFC. I think that could be a really fun fight. It would be a great kind of fight night headliner. You could have a lot of hype behind that. You could let both guys go in there, have a five-round atmosphere for both of them, because that's the thing. As a big Bellator fan, I didn't learn much about Michael Chandler last night. Like, he hits really hard. He has a good ground game. He didn't get hit, though, and that's always the question mark around Michael Chandler. He's a phenomenal fighter, but the chin, it's not that he has a bad chin by any means. It's just that would be one of the shortcomings of his game. But his game, other than that, is pretty much perfect. So I didn't learn a lot about Chandler. I would like to see him actually get into one of those back and forth kind of wars, because I need to know a little bit more about Michael Chandler than I do already. So I would do Chandler versus Gaethje and Poirier versus Oliveira.
Yeah, I like that too. And I think I'm going to give the UFC some free PR advice. Not that they need it, but and listen, there'll be no invoice coming, UFC. You can just take this advice and run with it. Now is your chance to really promote Dustin Poirier as a star in this sport, because the kid checks all the boxes for being a star for casuals. Like, you put him on Good Morning America. Let me explain something to the UFC that you may already know, but sometimes you're too close. You know, you can't see the forest for the trees. Casual fans don't know that Conor McGregor is not a champion, and they don't understand that beating Conor McGregor. So if you're going to put Dustin Poirier out there, tell everybody he was an underdog, which he was. Tell everybody that he beat Conor McGregor and how impressive beating Conor McGregor is and all those things. Don't bring up Khabib, because Khabib doesn't matter to casuals. This is the time to really push this kid. And if you can get – listen, he's a good-looking kid, loves his wife, has a foundation. He gets a little crazy with the fashion, like, so you can play that card too. Like, he's – you could put him on – I'm just saying, in the range of places you could put Poirier, you could put him on Good Morning America – with his family, and he could be with Desus and Mero. He could do both.
100%. Oh, I agree. No. John, they should hire you right now. Like, that's the perfect idea.
He could go everywhere. And once you give him that push, right, which not for nothing is what you probably should have done with Holly Holm back in the day, although Poirier has more marketable things than Holly Holm does, this kid could really, really, really be a star for you. And I think that that's the play. And then you book the Oliveira fight. But if you just want to say nothing for the next 3 months and then book the Oliveira fight, you're not going to get the kind of numbers that you want out of that fight. They really need to give this kid a marketing push. Put him everywhere. Find people that have nothing to do with him, right? Here's a perfect example. He's from Louisiana. I got Dustin Poirier doing something on social media with Joe Burrow because he went to LSU.
Him and Zion would hang out every other day.
I got him doing all, I find any little thing that can get me, you know, I got him as the grand marshal at Mardi Gras. If there's a Mardi Gras this year, I got this kid everywhere. That's what you need to do, because he can handle it. He can handle that type of limelight, because from his perspective, it's just going to put his foundation out there more. So he'll do all the press they want. That's the play. All right. Listen, we've said everything that can be said about Conor McGregor. And, well, real quick, what do you want for Conor next in terms of a fight? Nate Diaz was smart. He went to Twitter and called out Poirier.
I'm going to be honest. Nate Diaz got shut the hell up. You either fight or you don't fight, okay? And I get it. Everyone's a gangster until there's a real gangster. Here's the news. Dustin Poirier is everything you want Nate Diaz to be. Like, everyone's like, oh, Nate Diaz, he keeps it real, and he's got such good boxing, and look how good his jiu-jitsu is. Dustin Poirier's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, has as good of hands as Nate Diaz, hits quite a bit harder than him, though, and is just all around, I would say, argue, a better fighter. So Nate Diaz, get a win first. And I love Nate Diaz. I never thought I'd be here talking bad about him, but it gets old. I can only see you do this so many times. Like, every single time there's a big fight.
The fight night need... call out. Yeah, I'm with
exactly.
you.
Exactly. I don't need a Conor McGregor tweeting or a Nate Diaz or Jorge Masvidal. Like, at a certain point, I only care about what you do in the cage. And I get it. I'm a much more hardcore fan than a lot of other people out there. So those other people who aren't as involved in the sport might get more excited about stuff like that. But to me, like, Nate could fight Conor. Nate should not be calling out Dustin right now, because Dustin is only fighting for a title next. And there's no way the UFC is going to give Nate Diaz a title shot after how bad he looked against Jorge Masvidal. And here's the other thing. You know who's training partners with Jorge Masvidal? You know who fights just like Jorge Masvidal? Dustin Poirier. If you think Jorge Masvidal lumped up Nate Diaz, Dustin's going to do the exact same thing. Like, not that they're mirrored fighters by any means, but Dustin Poirier is pretty much a southpaw Jorge Masvidal with better jiu-jitsu. They fight in a very similar way.
Yeah, I don't like first of all, I don't think Diaz has earned the fight. So that's for starters. So that should be the end of the discussion. I think, somebody tweeted last night, there's never a better time for Nate Conner 3. That's absolutely correct. Do Nate Conner 3. You book that fight. Everyone forgets that Nate lost his last fight. Conner lost his last fight. Like, that fight has such a place in the consciousness of fans, non-MMA and MMA fans. Just book it. Cash the check. It's enough already.
I have a question for you, though.
What's that?
Do you think Conor McGregor versus Jorge Masvidal is a possibility at 170? Because they are both coming off losses, and you could have a bit of a storyline of, well, Poirier is Masvidal's training partner. Masvidal beat Diaz, so did McGregor. I'm not saying it's a perfect matchup, but do you think that could be in his future as well?
He brings that BMF title with him, yeah. I think that if they do it for the BMF title, yes. Here's the problem. I really want to see Colby Covington and Jorge Masvidal. I think that Colby Covington could beat Jorge Masvidal, and that takes away the shine of Jorge Masvidal. There's certain guys that if they lose, people can accept it because of what the public believes. So if Jorge Masvidal loses to Conor, because of what the public believes about Conor, whether it's true or false, they'll accept it. But if he loses to this guy they barely know, who's kind of a MAGA jerk off, then it takes a lot of shine away from Masvidal. You know, because if Conor beats Masvidal, they shake hands in the cage. It's this thing. Now, if Masvidal loses to a guy that he hates, it's just different. You know what I mean? So as much as I want to see those two fight, I think that the smarter fight to keep the shine on Masvidal and Conor would be for the two of them to fight. That's my thought. But you got to bring that BMF belt with you. So, All right, let's move on. Co-main event. Matt, I have a rule. I don't make intros longer than fights, so Michael Chandler put some pressure on me this week. Chandler said on the UFC preview, either I am what I say I am or I'm not. So I'll ask you what you saw in this one, with the filters being, is Michael Chandler what he says he is, or did Dan Hooker just sleep on him?
No, Michael Chandler's what he said he is. And again, people were hard on Craig and I for both picking Michael Chandler in this one. So I'm going to take a little bit of a premature victory lap. So just bear with me here. Michael Chandler was the Bellator lightweight champion. He was the Bellator lightweight champion 3 times. That doesn't happen by mistake. Like, I understand it might not be the UFC and the level of competition might not always be at the same level, but you don't become a champion fighting the best guys in the world like Benson Henderson, like Eddie Alvarez. You don't do that by accident. Him coming over to the UFC, I understand Dan Hooker's a phenomenal fighter. You don't have a fight of the year caliber fight with a guy like Dustin Poirier if you're not world-class yourself. But I didn't learn anything about Michael Chandler I didn't already know. He did the same Michael Chandler things he always does. And Dan Hooker, yes, he got put away, and he got put away in a very violent fashion, but Dan Hooker still fought like Dan Hooker, and Michael Chandler still fought like Michael Chandler. Like, if you get caught with an overhand left a minute into a fight when you're kind of cold and you haven't really, gotten used to the fight yet, you're going to go to sleep. I don't care who you are. And it's unfortunate, too. I haven't read anything about it today, so hopefully no breaking news has happened, but there was some reports that Dan Hooker took his gloves off and that he might retire. I hope not, personally. I understand Dan Hooker right now. Like, this is a really hard position for him to be in. I couldn't imagine having to be away from your family for months at a time just to get off, back-to-back losses now because he went through the same thing after fighting Poirier. Like, it's been a hard year for Dan Hooker. He's taken an ungodly amount of damage because you have to remember, he fought Paul Felder in February. That was arguably fight of the year. He fights Dustin Poirier in July, arguably fight of the year. Like, those are back-to-back car accidents. And then you fight Michael Chandler. It's not a negative that Dan Hooker's lost two in a row against these two guys. And for Michael Chandler, I wish I could say, okay, yeah, perfect. Like, you're the number one contender for Dustin Poirier, I guess, because there is no belt. But you haven't shown me enough. To me, he's still the same fighter he was before this fight. It doesn't change my opinion of Michael Chandler at all. I know he's got big power in his hands. I know he can wrestle. I know he's got good cardio, great ground and pound, good submissions, and his chin's questionable. All those questions still remain after the fight. So I didn't really learn that much about him. For Dan Hooker, it's a hard loss. It's a bad loss. And we've never really seen Dan Hooker get stopped like this before, especially not this early for a guy who's known for being one of those like blood and guts warriors. Like, you've got to hit Dan Hooker with a brick to put him away. But if I'm Dan Hooker, take 8 or 9 months off and reconsider. He is still fairly young. I know he's taken a lot of damage, but I would hate for this to be the last time we ever see Dan Hooker in an octagon.
Yeah. So I will say this, 100 years ago when I used to do this recap with somebody else, I can't remember his name. We used to talk about technique of the night. It was one of the things we did at the end of the show. I got to admit, man, one of my favorite techniques of the night was that punch to the midsection, that body punch, because it does, well, it does one of two things. It opened up that left hook for sure. And secondly, it also opens up the wrestling, because Hooker doesn't know, as he's lunging forward, is that punch going in my belly or is that arm going around my leg?
Another wrinkle to it, though. I think he was ducking to force the knees from Dan Hooker. Like, he knew Dan Hooker is only looking for the knee. It's Alistair Overeem does this. Alistair Overeem does not have a good chin. When he gets hit clean, he goes down. He knows, everyone knows he has a bad chin, though, so he sticks his head out to make you swing for it. I think Michael Chandler was also throwing that right hand to force the knee of Dan Hooker, because if Dan Hooker's focused on, he keeps on ducking, I can time his knee. While Dan Hooker's focusing on his timing, Michael Chandler can get his own shot off.
Yeah, and it's crazy because, like, that left hook was the only time he threw that behind the right hand. And it's like, I mean, I'm sure this happens in every fight. We've both seen it where guys are trying techniques and the other person reads it and it's not as effective. This was the thing he wanted to do in the first time he tried it. Worked perfectly. So, I mean, listen, is it an ideal situation for Chandler? Absolutely. But you kind of touched on this a little bit with Hooker, so let's spin this forward for both guys. 55,000 or 50,000? I'm guessing you're saying 50 with Hooker. Go back. Now, do you think it was a bad read? Do you think he should take the 8 months off because he's just taking so much damage? Or do you think that, like, there's something missing from his game? I mean, he's fought great fighters. Do you think he's missing a piece?
I don't think he's missing a piece. I think, listen, you live in the one country in the world that seems to have some sort of normalcy to it. There's a lot of restrictions that it takes for Dan Hooker to leave New Zealand and fly back. That's going to take a massive toll on your body, doing it over and over and over again. Like, you have to imagine, he spent, 2.5 months away from his house this year just because he had to fly to Vegas, he had to quarantine, do all that, quarantine coming back. Like, I don't want to see Dan Hooker fight during this pandemic. I don't want to see him have to go through all of that stress, all of the, you know, all the quarantine, just to have a fist fight. Like, look after yourself. You've been in, like I said, 3 back-to-back-to-back car crashes at this point. You're still fairly young. If I'm Dan Hooker, go to City Kickboxing. I know he's already there, but just keep on training, refine some of your tools. Cause Dan Hooker, I always use, like, Chris Boucher is a good example. When it's right, it's right. And it looks great. For Dan Hooker, it's the same thing. Like, when it's right, those first two rounds against Dustin Poirier, he looked phenomenal. Like, that's some of the best striking you will ever see, and really in any weight division. He was checking leg kicks. He was using his long range attacks. He was doing a great job judging distance. But for Hooker, I just think this year's kind of worn on him, and there's nothing against it. Like, it happens. I don't want to have to see him go through the whole leaving New Zealand, quarantining multiple times just to come back. Just take a little bit of time off. Let your body heal. That's what you really need anyways. And just, I just don't want this to be the last time we see Dan Hooker. I think he beats a lot of guys at 155. I'd favor him against a lot of the top guys. I'd love to see him fight Gaethje. I'd love to see him fight Ferguson. And I think he's got a lot left to give to the sport. So I would say just go back, kind of recollect yourself. Don't make any harsh decisions yet. And hopefully this isn't the last we see of Dan Hooker. If he does choose to retire, I completely understand. Like, 2020 has been a bad year for a lot of people. Dan Hooker was able to main event a UFC card, which is something few people will ever get the opportunity to reach the heights that Dan Hooker's been able to reach in MMA. If he decides this is it for him, I fully support it, but I really hope this isn't the last we see of him.
Yeah, I think that there's a few things at work here. I think that he needs to understand that, like, you know, he's building quite a legacy for himself with all these great wars that he's in, but it also takes a toll on the body. And when you wake up in the morning and when you're feeling foggy and all that shit, the fact that fans think that you're a warrior doesn't really mean anything. When you go home and your face is beat to hell and you got to face your kids, it doesn't mean a whole lot. So I think that he needs to take some time. The one thing he has going for him that I think will happen is I think that people will forget about this Chandler fight because it happened so quick. He's always got a fight of the year candidate fight with Dustin Poirier. So if Poirier continues doing what he's doing at 155, he'll be able to, you know, people are going to, I don't want to say they'll forget that Hooker lost, but they'll remember how good the fight was. And he may be able to book himself another fight with Poirier. If he takes some time off, let Poirier do his thing. You know, Poirier's probably got maybe a fight with Chandler, maybe a fight with Oliveira, maybe a trilogy fight with Connor. When all that's said and done, well, here comes Dan Hooker again after two maybe wins, after he's taking some time. Like, things might play themselves out better if he just slows down a little bit. He's not that old. I think he's like 30. So just give yourself some time to recoup a little bit and don't think you got to get right back in there and make people forget about this loss. It's a horrible loss, but you don't have to, you know, let the division play itself out a little bit. For Chandler, he made a 50,000 foot move last night with that post-fight interview. I think that it's a 5,000 foot place for him, because he's got real shots at he's got a real path to the title if he wants it. Like, he can get the fights that he wants to get, is my point. He was the alternate for the Khabib Dustin fight. He knocked out Hooker last night. So, I mean, he's kind of positioning himself. So you think he focuses on the belt and works his way towards that belt? Or do you think that he takes a big fight with, like, maybe like Ferguson or somebody that he thinks he could beat? What's the play here?
So Ferguson's a great name, because if I'm Michael Chandler, I don't go for the belt. I go for Poirier. And that does kind of see what Chandler's been doing, because, again, you know, Poirier's next fight is going to be for the title no matter what. So if you can just say, okay, I want Dustin, you're eventually going to get that fight. And again, like I said, they're going to attach a title the next time Poirier does get in there. I would be very surprised, though, if they do end up doing Michael Chandler versus Dustin next. I would love to see him fight the Tony Ferguson. I just need Michael Chandler to be in the 5-round club. It's a weird rule that I have where I don't want you to fight for a title until you go 5 rounds in the UFC. And I understand Michael Chandler, he's more than proven his ability to go 25 minutes. It's not for that. It's for the more mainstream fans who only know him from this 1-minute knockout. Like, people know Connor from his 1-minute knockout over Cowboy. They know fighters for their highlight reels. They don't know them for the totality of their careers. Whereas if Michael Chandler can go out there, have a back and forth fight with another top guy in the division, and really show that, like, I didn't just get a lucky punch against the guy coming off a loss. Like, if you can really cement yourself and dominate a guy, let's say he goes out there, he gets dropped by Gaethje in the first round of their fight, but he comes back strong in the second, out wrestles him, beats him up in the third. Let's say he chokes out Gaethje in like the fourth round, but it's his back and forth fight. That's going to secure Michael Chandler a title shot next. But I really need to see him have that next fight against a top tier fighter. Cause to me, if I'm thinking about the lightweight division, you always had Dustin, Tony, Khabib, and Connor. Those, for a while, they were just kind of the top. All those guys were just going to fight each other. And then Gaethje joined. Dan Hooker was never really a part of the elite of the elite. He was always on the outside looking in. He always felt like he was one win away from getting there. He had the opportunity against Poirier, of course. But for Dan Hooker, I think he's a phenomenal fighter. I just never saw him as one of those top guys who, oh, you beat Dan Hooker, you deserve a title shot. So for Chandler, I think this should set him up for hopefully a big fight after. They're not going to do this, but Benil Dariush is fighting Carlos Diego Fajeya in a couple of weeks. To me, that's a huge fight. I think it's like 8 versus 10 at the lightweight division. And of course, 2 ranked lightweights. The winner of that is going to get a big fight next. But for Chandler, keep on calling out Poirier. If I'm Chandler, I call out Nate Diaz, though. Like, everyone knows who Nate Diaz is, and you're the worst stylistic matchup for him in the UFC. Like, what's Nate going to do? Defend your takedowns? Not at all. And people, there's this big myth about Nate Diaz's jiu-jitsu where it's like, oh, the second he's on the mat, like, he's so dangerous off his back. He is dangerous off his back, but then you fight guys like Michael Chandler, and it's same thing, Tony Ferguson, Charles Oliveira. Like, yeah, Tony Ferguson's good off of his back, but let's talk about who he's fighting. Like, he's good off his back, not against Charles Oliveira. Nate Diaz is good off his back, but if he fights Michael Chandler, he's going to get taken down, pummeled into the ground, and just ground and pound it for like 25 minutes. So if I'm Chandler, just call out those big names in the division. I do believe Chandler is now in that elite. He's now joined the Dustin, Gaethje, Oliveira, Chandler. I know that tournament's been thrown around a little bit, but I really do think Chandler is probably going to fight Gaethje next, but I would continue to call out Poirier just to attach my name to him, because Poirier has so much hype right now.
Yeah, because you can kind of, we've talked about this before with other fighters, you can turn yourself into that boogeyman where nobody wants to fight you, and, you know, just by saying their name and them not saying your name. So I like that as well. All right, Matt, let's move on. Last night when I was watching the fights, I was asked of Jessica Eye, is she confident or what? My response was, it's a mixture of confidence and a lack of self-awareness. So, Matt, when I say evil, you say, no, I'm kidding. That's from a famous or infamous open workout. Anyway, what I saw in this one was someone in I just trying to will herself and bully herself to a victory, fighting just someone who was technically superior and confident in what they were doing. That's what I saw. What'd you see?
I agree with what you said. Now, this was the only pick on the card that I did flip-flop from our original predictions. I had Jessica Eye all week, and then I watched Jessica Eye interviews, and I did not like what I saw. And Jessica Eye is a very strange fighter, and some fighters are very emotional fighters, and that can be to their benefit. That can, you know, it can be a detractor as well. For Jessica, I hate it when she's an emotional fighter. We saw in the Cynthia Calvillo fight, it's like she has to work herself up to really get motivated for the fight, to kind of get herself into that fighter's mindset. She's like, oh, like, I am the underdog. Everyone's against me. But she's not really saying it to the fans. She's more hyping herself up. That's the way I always look at it. Like, I was not a great basketball player by any means, but the way that I always played basketball was, if you're not confident at all, you will not make a shot. But if you're feeling good, you're hanging out with your friends before the game, you're feeling great. If you just kind of get into that flow state, not think about it, you're going to do a lot better. And it's wild that I can say this on my couch and figure that out. For Jessica Ai, when she does get into that flow state, she's a decent fighter. Like, we've seen her beat Viviane Araújo, who a lot of people are high on. She just beat the brakes off Roxanne Modafferi. Jessica Ai beat her, and what was a very nice performance by her. But against Calderwood, it was that, like, oh, there's bad blood here. But everyone who's watching is like, why is there bad blood here? This doesn't make any sense. It was more Jessica Ai seemed to be hyping herself up all week, and I hated that. And like you had said, Calderwood just technically was the superior fighter in this. Calderwood in the clinch is absolutely filthy. She got those beautiful elbows over the top. She just hits you with a lot of weird Muay Thai strikes from nice angles too. I love her knees to the body. And it was odd. You could tell Jessica Ai was definitely going for the takedown. She went for it pretty much immediately. But as she was getting beat up in the clinch, I just don't understand why she kept on trying to engage in the clinch. You know that's Calderwood's best position by far. And Calderwood does have good power for this division. She's not going out there getting a ton of TKOs by any means. But when you fight Joanne Calderwood, she's not just going out there, Caitlin Chookagian, ha ha. And that's it. Like, Calderwood's going to try to put you away and going to really put decent combinations together. So for I just really question her game plan going into this fight. I understand you were going for more of a wrestling heavy style because, you know, Calderwood's not great on the ground. We saw that in her fight against Jennifer Maia. But if you're Jessica Ai and you were going to try wrestling, why did you only go for the same takedown time after time? She would try to get that body lock against the cage, and then she'd go for the single leg and not really do anything with it. She just kind of hold on to it, get hit in the head while she's going for it. And it was just kind of rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. So I really question the game plan of Jessica Ai coming into this fight.
Yeah, when I look at certain fighters, one thing I like is, like, you know, the efficiency of the way they're fighting. And in terms of, like, where am I at and what is the technique that this space calls for, and am I using it and am I being efficient? Felt like when she was in close, she had a plan there. When she was at distance, she had a plan there. So I don't know. I mean, I get the whole bad blood thing, but it just seemed to me like Joanne Calderwood was like, okay, the only way to really resolve this bad blood is to perform well. Yeah. And Jessica Ai was like having some grudge. You know, she wanted to, like, make a statement with either, like, a big impressive move or knockdown or whatever she wanted to do. And it was just like, no, no. Calderwood was like, no, no, the body of work I'm about to put forth is the statement. Right. The statement is, I'm much better than you in a lot of different positions. So this is settled, you know. Let's talk about these two. 55,000, 50,000. What do you think here? I mean, I don't see either one of these being, you know, fighters that can make big promotion wide moves. But do either of them need to head back to the gym, or can they start looking at title shots?
So we'll start with Calderwood, because I think this is a much easier sort of just case to study. Because you look at Calderwood, originally she was already supposed to fight Valentina. Of course, she takes the fight against Maia, loses that fight. She doesn't get her title shot. But if the UFC was already willing to put her in there with Valentina, and it's not like a lot of people are raising their hands right now to fight Shevchenko, Calderwood should get one of those top tier fighters. Now, I think she should fight Lauren Murphy next. I think that's kind of the perfect fight right now, because you'd have to assume Jessica Andrade is going to fight Valentina Shevchenko. Andrade knocked out the number one contender with a body shot in the first round. That's as impressive as a performance as you're going to get. Calderwood should fight Lauren Murphy, I would say. That could kind of be your next number one contender fight, because Lauren Murphy, she's been calling for that title shot. She's been putting in the work. She was the FNP 2020 female fighter of the year because of it. And I think that would just stylistically be a very fun fight. You know, Lauren Murphy comes to fight every single time. She's got a very fun style. Same thing with Joanne Calderwood. And right now there is that weird logjam, because I truly believe Jessica Andrade is the second best flyweight in the world, no matter what. Like, I don't think anyone in the division beats Andrade, not named Shevchenko. And I don't think anyone not named Andrade can beat Shevchenko. Like, those two are head and shoulders above everyone else right now. It's kind of like heavyweight for a while. It was like, we have Cain, we have JDS. And, like, you kind of have to beat JDS if you want to fight Cain Velasquez, because he's just better than everyone else. And it took years for someone to finally beat JDS. And then, of course, you know, now Stipe's the GOAT. But for, I feel like this division just in a similar place. Calderwood, I would assume, is going to get either the Murphy fight. Maybe they do a Chookagian one. Personally, just from a fan perspective, I'd much rather see her fight Lauren Murphy because I do think that'd be a very fun fight. For Jessica Eye, and I'd love to get your opinion on this too. She's in my, I'll call it the shit list because that's what Charles Barkley calls it. Because Charles Barkley, of course, one of the greatest players to never win a title. Jessica Eye always seems to me like she's one loss away from getting cut. And that it's an awful thing to say. I don't feel good saying that. But she's a fighter who's definitely not on the front nine of her career. She's on like hole 17 about to walk to the 18th hole. And she, her skill set hasn't improved over time. If anything, it started to regress backwards. So do you think this could be the last we've ever seen of Jessica Eye in the UFC?
Well, women's fighting is interesting in that, you know, you can be one fight away from getting cut and two fights away from a title shot. So, you know, it's weird in that way, but I'm with you. I don't see the, you know, it's not like everyone has to defend their spot on the roster, but I don't see from her what I would want to see from her necessarily to feel like, you know, a lot of times it comes down to what's that fighter's number. Like, how much am I paying this fighter? And if they're gone, are they going to go anywhere and is it going to matter? I don't know where Jessica I would go other than the UFC where it matters. I mean, they might get one or two fights out of her in another promotion, but nobody's going to be like, guess who we signed? Jessica I, and have the crowd go wild.
You don't want to see her in bare knuckle against Paige VanZant?
That, see, now that Paige went to bare knuckle, things open up. But yeah, so I mean, she can fight Ostovich. There's fights out there for her, but I don't think the UFC was necessarily going to like see her fighting Paige VanZant and bare knuckle and go, man, I wish we would have kept her. So I'm with you. I think that she might be on the way out. All right, moving forward, a lot of these, you know, this was a weird card for me, and I'm going to run through these in a unique way, I think, because there were some fights on the prelims that I thought felt like they should have been on the main card and vice versa. The next fight, Mahmoud Muradov and Andrew Sanchez, felt like a prelim fight to me. It was on the main card. What'd you have here? I mean, I thought it was a pretty good fight.
I thought it was a good fight too. Now, Andrew Sanchez is a very interesting fighter because he wrestles himself into exhaustion constantly. Like, that's just his trademark. I've never seen a guy go out there and get two 10-8 rounds just to get finished in the third. And that was the calling card of Andrew Sanchez. Now, here's the great thing. He seemed like he had fixed a lot of those issues he saw in the Wellington Termon fight. He went out there with that longer karate stance, and his striking has looked a lot better. The issue was he was just fighting a hammer last night, and he was trying to strike with him. And I really like the way that Andrew Sanchez does strike now. I like that he has adopted more of a karate style because it does allow more of an in and out, and I think it helps his wrestling a lot. Georges St-Pierre, if he proved anything, is that there's different parts of other martial arts that can help you in others. Like, he really attributes a lot of his wrestling success to his karate background because it helps him judge distance so well. And I do think Andrew Sanchez, I can't believe that I'm comparing Andrew Sanchez to Georges St-Pierre right now. Bear with me. I think he was starting to have sort of that similar style where he figured out, okay, if I stand like this, I can get in, I can get out, and I won't be as hittable. And it was interesting because Mahmoud Muradov, you could tell just how powerful he is, especially by that overhand right that finished it, but he kept on missing with that overhand right, and he kept on missing with it over and over and over again. Like, Sanchez was fast enough to get out of the way. But like Allen Iverson, you kind of knew that once he loses that really fast first step, like, it was going to go downhill pretty fast. Like, Sanchez was just getting out of the way and just getting out of the way. And you kind of felt like, okay, if he gets tired even a little bit, one of those is going to land. And of course, it ended up landing. I didn't learn a lot about Mahmoud Muradov in this fight, though. And I know that's odd to say, but he defended a couple takedowns, but he just kept on going for that overhand right over and over and over and over and over. It wasn't like he did start to incorporate more kicks and whatnot. It was a beautiful finish, don't get me wrong, but I expected more out of Mahmoud Muradov, even though he did win the fight by knockout in the third round. And I know that's a wild statement to say that I expected more of a guy who got a very impressive stoppage, but I just thought he should have shown a slightly more diverse set of striking. I didn't like how he went to the well over and over and over again with that same strike. Cause I look at middleweight and you look at the top 15, think about how many good fighters right now aren't ranked in the top 15 in middleweight. Like, Sean Strickland isn't ranked right now. Karl Roberson's a pretty good fighter. He's not ranked right now. And there's fighters out there who are going to give Mahmoud Muradov a really hard fight. He just hasn't come up against them yet. So I like the ceiling of Muradov, but I don't think I'm as high on him as I was going into this fight. And for Andrew Sanchez, it's kind of odd because I think that he has shown a good progression in his skill set. He went from just being the wrestler, and now he's a little bit too striking heavy. if he could kind of be like Goldilocks and find what's just right for him, he still could go on a decent run because he has some good wins in the UFC. But I just think Andrew Sanchez, he needs to figure out what he does well. He knows he has the karate striking now. He knows he has the wrestling, but he's not like Henry Cejudo, who was able to combine the two and really incorporate them together. He's very much sort of a fighter with a bunch of these parts. He just hasn't put them all together yet.
Yeah, so I mean, long story short, I agree with everything you said. Long story short, these fighters to me don't even really register on the 5,000 range or the 50,000 range. They're still at 50 feet, worried about their own personal growth. All right, Matt, I don't know if you heard, but everyone loves Amanda Ribas. She seemed poised to become UFC's next it girl. Then along came Marina Rodriguez to crash the party. Ribas had Rodriguez on the ground early, but couldn't find a finish. And in the second round, Rodriguez dropped and swarmed on Ribas. Then it got weird with her Dean stepping in, but not stepping in. Really quickly, credit to Rodriguez for keeping her focus in this and still finding the stop. The stop was TKO, 54 seconds of the second round. That's how it played out. What'd you see in this one?
It was a weird fight. First of all, Rodriguez has made massive improvements every single fight, and I do think she needs to be credited for that, because you saw her grappling earlier on in her UFC career. She was getting taken down a lot, and I understand she still got taken down in this fight, but she kept her guard composed. She didn't do anything crazy. She didn't panic on the ground, especially with someone like Ribas, who is so dangerous from that top position. You know, she has a trillion different submissions that she can go to at any time. I like the composure from Rodriguez. She didn't freak out. She didn't do anything too irrational. And she knew that on the feet she had Ribas's number, because Marina Rodriguez, I compared her a lot to Jermaine Duranemi, and I got some very mean DMs on Instagram because of it. I still think her striking has a lot of similarities to Duranemi. She throws those big, long, straight shots. She has power at the end of a lot of her shots, and she's really good at judging distance and range. For Rodriguez, it's weird too, because I don't know if I'm making an excuse for Ribas. I picked Ribas. I don't like how her dad came out and said that she weighed 143 pounds the day of the fight. If you're a woman cutting 30 pounds, like, that's 30% of your overall body weight. That's not healthy at all. And I understand, like, Poirier, he cut down from what, like 185 down to 155, or that was at least the story after the Dan Hooker fight. It's a little bit different when you do weigh that extra and you have, you're, you know, more heavily muscled, so you can drain a little bit of water from that. But I am very curious if her inability to take a shot was due to that weight cut, but I think the strike in Marina Rodriguez looked amazing. And here's the great thing for Rodriguez right now. I think there is a perfect fight to be matched up with after this. And I said this for whoever won this fight. Amanda Ribas had a lot of hype behind her. She was in that kind of Macy Barber-esque range where you're not a big superstar in the UFC. You're not one of the more hyped up fighters in the UFC, but you have more hype than average. And you know that good things are going to happen to these people if they keep on winning. Not to say that Rodriguez stole all of her hype, but I do see her on a similar trajectory. I want to see Marina Rodriguez fight Rose Namajunas next. Rose Namajunas is just waiting on the sidelines right now, and Dana White is maybe making up lies that she's been offered a title shot, maybe not. But that would be a perfect fight to see her get back in there with. I know she had that beautiful fight with Andrade last year. That was that back-and-forth war. For Rose Namajunas, for me, I just want to see her be active. I understand she's going to be at the top of the division skill set-wise no matter what. I would just like to see her be active, and for Rodriguez, that would be the perfect next step for her, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the short answer here is that we, you know, for Ribas, it's back to 50 feet to figure out the hands. But, you know, like you said, Rodriguez can really take a look at the division. I mean, she had a draw with Calvillo. She lost to Esparza. Now she's beaten Ribas. I like your calls for where she moves forward. I think that she, again, she can start making her way. This is a pretty loaded division. I mean, there's Claudia Gadelha's out there. I mean, there's some fights out there for her that are interesting, but you're right. I mean, I just don't know if I would put her in there. I don't hate the matchup. I just don't know if, having just lost to Esparza, she's earned a fight with a former champ yet. That's my only that's my only pushback to your call. All right, let's move on. Armand Sarukian defeated Matt Frivola via unanimous decision. Couple 30-27, 30-26. What'd you have here?
That was a really fun fight. That was a fun scramble fest. Good on Matt Frivola, first of all, because here's the thing. He had, first of all, maybe the strangest fight week of anyone. He was fighting a guy who decided to cut off his wristband, give it to someone else, and who knows what was in that bag. Like, I keep on calling it the Pulp Fiction briefcase because no one really knows what's in it, but boy, would I like to know. And Matt Frivola was able to still keep his head straight, and it was interesting too, because both these guys were originally in one of those grappler versus striker matchups. Of course, Tsarukyan was supposed to fight Nasrat Haqparast, a primary boxer. People call him mini Kelvin Gastelum for a reason. And Matt Favola was supposed to fight Otman Azaiter, a primary boxer. So it was interesting seeing both guys not really be able to go into this fight with their original game plan, because now, of course, they're fighting another grappler. And for Matt Favola, I liked his wrestling in this fight. Honestly, I think his stock kind of rose. Like, the fact that he fought so well against a guy who was a 9-1 favorite over him, I don't think Matt Favola lost any stock at all. If anything, I think Dana White thinks a lot more of him for taking a fight like this on such short notice. For Tsarukyan, I'm pretty down on him for missing weight. I can't lie. But you look at what he's been able to do in his young UFC career, just really in his young career in general. The guy's only 24 years old, and people forget his UFC debut was against Islam Makhachev, and it was a fight of the night. Like, there's ranked fighters right now who would not be able to stay in there long enough with Islam Makhachev and have a fight of the night type of a fight. So even though he was on the losing end of that, he was able to come back, beat Olivier Aubin-Mercier, fellow Canadian, and Davi Hamos, and then, of course, Matt Favola. So Armin Tsarukyan, if he can get his weight together, and hopefully it's not an issue moving forward, I really like him against a lot of guys at 155 pounds. He's got dynamic striking. He's got a really fun style of grappling, too, where he's not just going to take you down and lay on top of you. He will get into those kind of scramble fests and look for an opportunity in the scrambles. So it was one of those rare fights where I do think both guys are kind of winners, even though one missed weight and the other one, of course, lost the fight.
Let's move on. Brad Tavares defeated Antonio Carlos Jr. via unanimous decision, 30-27s, a couple of them in 29-28. I like this fight, and I thought Tavares looked good coming off the injury. What would you think here?
I agree. It was odd that both guys were coming off ACL tears, just not something you normally see in MMA. Antonio Carlos Jr. has beautiful jiu-jitsu. If you've ever seen him compete just in straight jiu-jitsu, he's a phenomenal grappler. The issue is, and it's an issue that a lot of MMA grapplers, if you will, run into, is that he doesn't have the wrestling to tie his striking with his jiu-jitsu. And I think the best example for this now is Gilbert Burns. Like, Gilbert Burns went from, I have insane jiu-jitsu and I have really good power in my hands, but I don't really have the technique on the feet and I don't have the wrestling to get my opponents down. Now you look at what Gilbert Burns is able to do. Like, he trained his wrestling with Kamaru Usman and Michael Chandler for years at Sanford MMA, and you see what he's been able to develop into as just an overall MMA grappler, not just a jiu-jitsu practitioner looking for takedowns. If I'm Antonio Carlos Jr., that's all I focus on, because his striking did look a little bit better in this fight. The cardio is always an issue for him, though, and it does concern me again. When you are going for those takedowns with not a lot of technique behind them, you're just trying to drag your opponent to the ground constantly, you're going to get tired. And for Brad Tavares, kind of a classic Brad Tavares fight. Now, Craig and I both had Antonio Carlos Jr. in this fight. I think it was like the brother of a sparring partner of Brad Tavares hopped in our comments, and they were not happy with some of the comments that we had made about his boy Brad Tavares. But it was a classic Brad Tavares fight. He defended takedowns like he's known to do, and he has good striking. Now, Brad Tavares to me is like a bigger version of Ally Quinta. If you're a wrestler, he's got good enough wrestling to counter your takedowns, and his striking is good enough to outstrike most guys who go in there with a grappling game plan. And it's kind of the flip side too. If you're a primary striker, he has good enough wrestling to get you to the ground, but he's not going to out grapple those top tier grapplers. Like, he can just kind of do the opposite of whatever your specialty is. And that worries me for Brad Tavares against the elite of the elite. But I thought he looked really good, especially coming off a big long layoff, coming off that loss to Israel Adesanya. I thought he looked as good as he possibly could in this fight.
Yeah, he's lost a couple. I mean, he lost to Adesanya, lost to Shabazian. So he's in a weird spot where he's at rank 14. The guys above him are not necessarily, you know, they're starting to have their ascension, right? So Omari Akhmedov's above him, Shabazian he's already fought, Weidman, Holland, Uriah Hall, Kelvin Gastelum. So, I mean, Heinisch is right below him. So there's some interesting fights out there for him. Here's what I thought about Brad Tavares, which has nothing to do with anything, but it's an interesting thought. I always try and go have this thought exercise where it's like, okay, who's the next Jorge Masvidal? Meaning, who is kind of laying in that top 15, got some skills, been in big fights with guys, but never quite. And here's – I don't think Brad Tavares would be the next – Jorge Masvidal for this reason, but I'll tell you why. Because the more I started to break it down, basically what has to happen for you to be that sort of sensation in the UFC is you have to win or be in kind of big fights or good fights and then do something drastic. And then after you do something drastic, you continue to win. And that's a hard thing. So for example, Masvidal was a good fighter for a lot of years, and the next thing you know, he's got long hair and a beard, and we're like, who's this guy? And then he goes out and starts knocking people out. Starts, has the Leon Edwards thing. Sean O'Malley, same thing. Looks like a cornball the first time we see him. knocks a guy dead. Then he colors his hair and he gets all these tattoos, and then he continues to win, right? Darren Till would have done this. He is a good fighter. Then he becomes this like Twitter phenomenon, you know, but he just didn't continue to win. So that's where I think, although Brad Tavares checks certain boxes, I don't know that he checks all those, but I think that he could make, I think he's always going to be a gatekeeper. I would never see him in the top five, but I think that he can make things interesting, at least maybe cracking the top 10. Side note, he used to go to World Series of Fighting events because he's friends with Ray Sefo, or trains with Ray Sefo. You never seen a more beautiful woman than his girlfriend. I mean, really? Oh my God. She walked in, and you thought she was a celebrity. She walked in, I was looking at her, I'm like, is it worth getting beaten up by Brad Tavares just to look at this woman? I mean, it's a toss up. All right. So hopefully
he's a winner inside and outside of the cage.
Yeah, so hopefully his brother of his friend, whatever, is not in these comments. All right, moving on. Juliana Pena defeated Sarah McMahon by submission via rear naked choke. Listen, man, I've been caping for Juliana Pena for a lot of years, and I really think that she needs to get, Lauren Murphy. There's a list of these people that need to get their shot, right? Did you see enough in this? I'll jump right to you can tell me what your thoughts are on the fight, but I'll sort of jump right to the end of the story here. Did you see enough in this fight for the UFC to give her a push towards that belt? No? What'd you say?
Not at all. I saw Sarah McMahon have the worst fight IQ in UFC history, and I just think she might be the owner of that. And I hate to say this, but I'll bring myself back to this. Like, you think when you play sports as a kid, or just you're playing sports even now, like in a pickup game, you know what you do well and you know what you don't do well. For Sarah McMahon, she's a phenomenal wrestler. I don't understand why she wouldn't match her jiu-jitsu along with her wrestling. And she has come out and publicly said that she's not the biggest fan of jiu-jitsu. Like, she thinks all she needs is wrestling to be a really dominant MMA fighter. It's not true at all. Like, Sarah McMahon just gives up when she's on her back. I've never seen a worse fighter off of their back. And this is really harsh criticism, but it's the truth. Sarah McMahon is so dominant in that top position. She has submission. She has ground and pound. She can pass your guard. She has phenomenal grappling from the top position. But you look at her off of her back, and she just makes a lot of really rookie mistakes.
Yeah, I think for me, what's interesting about Juliana Pena is that she's a little bit like John Fitch in the sense that she's better than most, but not a champion, right?
And so that was the call out, too.
What's that?
That was the call out. Like, her call out of Amanda Nunes, listen, that's a tough one. Like, I understand, shoot big, you might get big, but like, Amanda Nunes right now has transcended women's MMA, and that's a wild thing to say, but like, she doesn't even have competitive fights anymore. They can't put people in there with her who can even last until the last bell. And if they do, they're absolutely lumped up by the end of it. And Juliana Pena, yeah, she has good jiu-jitsu, which I guess she has, or Nunes hasn't fought anyone like Pena, but I guess she has. No, look what she did to Felicia Spencer. And like, Felicia Spencer's a pretty good grappler. And Amanda Nunes made it look like she didn't even belong in there grappling with her. Like, I just don't see what Juliana Pena can do against Nunes. And maybe she does get a push towards the title shot, and that would be nice for her. But the fact that people, or at least myself, I'm always going to remember Juliana Pena as the grappler who got submitted by two strikers. Valentina Shevchenko armbarred her off of her back, and Jermaine Duranemi guillotined her standing. And it's nothing against Juliana Pena. Even Charles Oliveira has been submitted in the past. But you look at who Charles Oliveira got submitted by. He's been submitted by Jim Miller, by Anthony Pettis, like guys who have phenomenal jiu-jitsu. Juliana Pena has been submitted by average grapplers in the UFC. And I just, especially for women's bantamweight and featherweight, I always have to ask myself, what new wrinkle can you offer the champ Amanda Nunes? Because let's be honest, it's not like Juliana Pena is fighting anyone else for that title. So you just have to compare to Nunes. I have no idea what Juliana Pena could do to Amanda Nunes. Like, every second she stands on the feet with her, Juliana Pena is very tentative striking. She doesn't really like to let her hands go a lot. She keeps her hands very close to herself. If you're fighting Amanda Nunes, it's not going to end well. She doesn't have kicks. Amanda Nunes has kicks. Her wrestling's good, but I wouldn't say it's great. And on the mat, I would argue Nunes is as good as Pena, if not better.
Well, here's the thing. That's spoken like a guy who does previews for fights. So you've eliminated all the reasons why Pena could win. And I admire that about you. But here's, from a guy that looks to promote fights or looks to build things, build cases, here's the case you can build for Juliana Pena. She's only lost to champions. Durandamy, not only, but Durandamy in recent memory. Shevchenko, Durandamy, and who's the other one? am I missing? Doesn't matter. So she's lost to those two. But, oh, Shevchenko, Durandamy, and...
I'm looking up Shevchenko, Durandamy, and then she had lost earlier in her career against Sarah Morris and Deanne Bennett. But those are only two UFC losses.
I think in my brain I was giving her the Nunes loss already. But anyway, so she's lost to Durandamy and she's lost to Shevchenko. But she's beaten Jessica Ai. She's beaten Kat Zingano. Now she's beaten Sarah McMahon. This is my point.
If you look at all those fighters, especially where they were at their career, like Jessica Ai was on a 5-fight losing streak when she beat her. Kat Zingano was on a 2-fight losing streak and took 2 years off before she fought her at UFC 200. Nico Montano is a 125er forced to fight at 135 because she can't make weight. Like, I agree with what you're saying, but there's such a big discrepancy between her wins and her losses. I just don't know where to put her skill set.
No, that's what I'm saying. But she's better than the you know what I'm saying? Like, she's better than most of the top 10, but not championship level. So I think that's a fighter that you can promote. So I'm not saying that she necessarily would win the fight. I'm saying there's a path towards her at least getting it and being promoted. She's a very attractive young lady. She's got the wins that she would need. She beat the person who beat Nunes in Zingano. So that's all you need. All you need is MMA math to promote fights. Now, to pick them, it's a different story. All right, let's move on. Marcin Prochniou defeated Khalil Roundtree Jr. via unanimous decision. 29-28 all around. This is a pretty good fight. I remember thinking that Roundtree was going to do much better in this fight. And I was – what'd you say?
Okay, so Marcin Prochniou, everyone knows him as the guy who looked like he was carrying groceries across the cage and then Sam Alvey just knocked him out because his hands were down by his sides. Here's the thing about Marcin Prochniou. You look at his record in the UFC. First round knockout loss to Sam Alvey. Sam Alvey doesn't really knock people out nowadays. First round knockout loss to Magomed Ankalaev. You can throw that out because Ankalaev legit is like a world-class talent. And then again, first round knockout to Mike Rodriguez. I assume Khalil Roundtree would be able to do what those three previous fighters were also able to do. Khalil's a very odd case though because he's got a little bit of that Uriah Hall-ness in him where he just seems a little tentative. He doesn't want to let his hands go. But you saw in the second round when he did start to let his combinations and hands go, he was having success. He was landing those big hooks, and they were really taking a toll on Prochniou. But for Khalil, I don't know if it's a muscle thing. I don't know if maybe he just doesn't have good cardio in the first place. But like Craig had mentioned it when he was walking out. He's like, that does not look like those are body goals. Like Khalil Roundtree carries around so much muscle that if you do overexert yourself like he did in that second round, kind of looking for the finish, you're not going to be there for the third round. I understand a lot of people were upset about the decision. People thought Khalil should have won because he was landing the more damaging shots. But to me, if you judge it round by round, which is what you have to do, 10-9 round one for Prochniou, 10-9 round two Roundtree, and 10-9 Prochniou round three. I understand Roundtree, I would say he won the second round more than Prochniou won the first and third rounds, but unfortunately you can't get like a 8.5 point round. It's still going to be a 10-8 just because he didn't do enough to really secure that 10-8. So I understand people might be frustrated with that decision. I'd be more frustrated with just Khalil's output, especially in that third round. He let the fight get away from him. I felt it was a very winnable fight, especially going into the third round, because you were fighting a guy who at that point had just eaten an overhand right from you, or a right hook, and a left high kick. Like, he was very hurt in between those two rounds, and he let Prochniou slowly get back into the fight. So that's a bad loss for Roundtree, especially losing to a guy who was coming off three first-round knockout losses. But Prochniou 100% just saved his UFC job last night.
Mavzar Evloev defeated Nick Lentz via split decision, 28-29, a couple 29-28s. What'd you have here?
One of the judges was drunk and not watching the fight. That would have been the judge who gave it to Nick Lentz. Unfortunately, I did just see this morning Nick Lentz did decide to retire after this fight. He said that he lost about 40% of the vision in his eyes due to fighting, which is just a wild price to pay to fight in a cage. Just absurd to me. Mavzar Evloev is a problem, though. Nick Lentz is going to Nick Lentz. You know what he's really good at? He's got that phenomenal guillotine, and he's got 6 or 7 different guillotines. This is what I really like about Nick Lentz. He had said it in the Will Brooks fight, and I always go back to this Will Brooks fight. He let Will Brooks take him down multiple times. But what he do was he was just getting a feel for where he was putting his head, Will Brooks was, and just kind of getting a feel for, okay, these are his entries on his takedowns. I'm not going to resist them all that much. I'll just wait for my opportunity. And then once he found Will Brooks, put his head in that perfect position, he snatched onto the guillotine and was, of course, able to finish him. You could tell he was going for the same plan against Evloev, but Mavsa looked good. Like, his striking is dynamic. He's got volume. He's got power. He's got nice kicks. And his wrestling and overall scrambling ability is really, really high level. So it's wild that that one judge somehow found an excuse to give Nick Lentz two of those three rounds. But I was really high on Monzar Evloev after that fight. I like his call out too. Listen, if they bring a translator in and you push off the translator to try to speak English for yourself, I'm going to be a fan of you no matter what. Like, just you making that opportunity to help market yourself, I think goes a long way. And what he said after his fight was, I'm not going to ask for someone in the 50 or top 15. Find someone in the top 15 who deserves to fight me. That's a great line when you are sort of one of those boogeymen outside of the division. So Monzar Evloev is really looking up for him.
All right, Amir Albazi defeated Zalgas Zumagulov. Unanimous decision, 29-28. It's all over the place. That's a mouthful. How was the fight?
It was a good fight. Zalgas Zumagulov, in his first fight against Halyan Paiva, again, Craig and I thought both of us thought that he won that fight, even though he was on the wrong end of a decision. He didn't look bad in this fight by any means. He started off the fight very well. He has nice striking at range, but Amir Albazi, there's a reason he is so hyped up right now. He only had one win in the UFC, and he was already ranked in the top 15. Now, I understand it's not like the flyweight division has that many fighters in it, so you can get ranked quite easily, but he's only 27. He's got a phenomenal wrestling game, and we didn't even really see as much of that in the fight. Like, he stood and struck with Zalgas for the majority of the fight, and I do like that Amir Albazi, he's not afraid to mix it up. He knows what he does well in the wrestling, but he has a certain level of comfort in his striking where he can go out there, throw hands with you for a little bit, make you think about the striking more, and then he'll work in his takedown. So it was a really nice performance by Amir Albazi, and I'm very excited to see where he goes from here.
Yeah, he's interesting because he's, to me, like one of those guys that looks like he reminds me, you know, with my half a casual, half a hardcore mindset of like Gavin Tucker, where you see him in a vacuum. And you're like, oh, this kid's showing me some stuff. But then you're like, oh, he's the first fight of the night or he's on the prelims. Is it based on his opponent or does he really have like the foundation of something special? So we'll see. All right, Matt, let's hit the wrap. We'll start with some housekeeping notes. Performance of the nights. Dustin Poirier versus Conor McGregor, $50,000 to Poirier. Dan Hooker versus Michael Chandler, $50,000 to Chandler. Andrew Sanchez versus Mahmoud Muradov, $50,000 to Muradov. Marina Rodriguez versus Amanda Ribas, $50,000 to Rodriguez. Would you give bonuses to anybody other than those four?
If you're going to limit yourself to only four bonuses, it would have been kind of nice if they gave Juliana Pena $50,000. Because listen, there was five finishes on the card. If you're going to give out four bonuses, you might as well give out five bonuses. It sold 1.6 million pay-per-view buys, so I doubt the UFC really cares about that extra 50 grand. But I agree with all those stoppages. Again, you know they're always going to give a performance bonus to someone in the main event 9 times out of 10. Whoever wins by finish, doesn't really matter how spectacular the finish itself was. It's just more of a promotional tool. Like, there's a reason that when Dustin Poirier walks out, they're like, oh, he's tied for third all-time in performance bonuses with 11. Like, they use that to hype the fighter. So, of course, they're going to give it to the more well-known fighters. But Dustin Poirier knocked out Conor McGregor. Is that really a sentence you thought either one of us would be saying today? Like, he starched him in the second round, knocked him out on the feet. That's a wild thing to say. So, of course,
yeah,
he deserves it.
Yeah, it is. But
Michael Chandler, UFC debut, knocks out one of the toughest fighters ever with one punch. Of course, he deserves it. And then the Marina Rodriguez, I love the fact that she was such a big underdog and was able to get a beautiful stoppage. And I would probably give the other bonus to Muradov. If you wanted to give it to Juliana Pena, I can't hate on you for it. But Pena's finish came because Sarah McMahon gave it to her. Like, Sarah McMahon was not doing the right things on the ground. So I attribute that finish more to the shortcomings of Sarah McMahon instead of just how good Juliana Pena looked. Whereas Muradov just landed an absolute bomb on Andrew Sanchez.
Yeah, you know they're going to give bonuses to the people with the higher profiles. I think that Juliana Pena made herself some money last night by picking up a victory. So I'm happy to see someone at Muradov's level get paid the 50 grand. All right, let's hit the victory lap. Let's talk about where you were right last night.
I bet Michael Chandler inside the distance, and I had that parlayed with Dustin Poirier winning, and those odds were insane. So your boy had a pretty good night. It was a very nice card for me. I had Dustin Poirier the whole time. I was very confident in that. I had a lot of friends who texted me saying, like, I don't know why you're so confident in him. I don't even know why I was so confident in him. But I really like what Poirier had said after the fight, and it kind of goes with what we were talking about earlier about how, like, Conor McGregor really needs to assess, like, his camp and whatnot. John Kavanaugh had a quote before the fight, and it was interesting. He was like, no matter what happens, Dustin Poirier will never forget what Conor McGregor did to him the first time. Like, that's always going to be in the back of his head. And I don't know if you saw, but after the fight, when Conor and Dustin were talking to each other, Dustin looked at John Kavanaugh, and he was like, you were right. I can't forget, but I can forgive myself for losing. And that's a wild thing to actually be able to say to yourself. Like, yeah, you were better than me then, but that has nothing to do with what we're doing tonight. So I couldn't be more impressed with what I saw from Dustin Poirier. I was I thought Michael Chandler was going to win this fight inside the distance. I was pretty cocky about it. Borderline arrogant, some might even say. But you look at what Michael Chandler was able to do outside the UFC, and this is what I hate. I hate that everyone discredits every fighter outside the UFC. I understand not every outside the UFC champion is created equal. If a guy's a Bama world champion, it doesn't mean as much as being the Bellator lightweight champion. But Michael Chandler, if you've been following along and if you've been watching, you knew that he was this kind of fighter from the get-go. And again, he didn't really prove anything to me last night. Like, I still know what I know about Michael Chandler. He hits very hard. He's got great wrestling. He's going to put on a fun fight. Let me see, what else? I flip-flop between Jessica Eye, Joanne Calderwood. That was nice. Not my best card prediction-wise. I think I went 7-4. We're not going to talk about Craig's record. It might have been the opposite of that. But overall, I think I did pretty well. And the ones that I was confident about, they ended up going through.
All right, so then let's, we kind of gave us your things you missed on as well. Let's talk about some takeaways. What are you taking away from this night?
I think Michael Chandler can be a star in the UFC. I know we talked about Dustin Poirier and kind of his upside and his mainstream appeal. That post-fight call-out for Michael Chandler is all I saw on Twitter today. Now, yes, I saw a lot of like Conor McGregor sleeping memes, and I saw a lot of Bernie Sanders and glove memes. But Michael Chandler, the fact that he did go out there and he gave a WWE kind of promo, but it didn't feel overly campy. Like, it never crossed the line towards, like, you know, Henry Cejudo, Jessica Eye levels of cringe. Like, it was a very confident statement the whole time. He just did it in a way that has more of a mainstream appeal. So I really do think Michael Chandler is one of the guys on this card who can become a more mainstream star.
You know, it was interesting because it was an exaggeration of who he is, not necessarily a departure from who he is. It was just him kind of with the volume turned up. And I think that if you don't know who Michael Chandler is, and that was your introduction to him last night, then you're like, oh, wow, this is now your reality of him. And if you do know who he is, you weren't put off by it necessarily. You know what I mean? Like, I knew who he was, and it kind of caught me off guard a little bit. But I was like, okay, this kid's taking a turn. I can appreciate that. So, you know, I think it was probably smart on his part. So, which leads me right into the next question, which I think I know the answer. The answer is probably Matt Allen, but I'll ask you the next. I'll ask you to pick another one. Who won the night?
Dustin Poirier won the night. You knocked out the most popular fighter in the world. Like, I don't know if Dustin Poirier will get a Nate Diaz level of rub off of this fight, but it's interesting. I do feel like Poirier was becoming, I'm not going to say a mainstream star by any means, but I'd argue Poirier, even going into this fight, was one of the UFC's bigger names, at least in-house. Like, Dustin Poirier can always main event a show, no matter what it is, be it a fight night, be it a pay-per-view, and is going to put up decent numbers because people like the story. And I don't know about you, but I remember watching Fightville when I was in high school. Like, it came out in 2011, so I would have been going into grade 8. And then I remember when I was in grade 9, I actually ended up watching the documentary, and I've been a fan of his ever since. So if you followed his trajectory, and if you ever heard him on like podcasts, and he was on Theo Vaughn's podcast, like one of the wilder stories, just he was in juvenile detention as a kid. He was acting out a lot, got kicked out of a bunch of schools. He was really, well, he was quite a bit larger, we'll say, than he is now. He was out of shape. His wife is 100% ride or die. Like, if you really do a deep dive into Dustin Poirier's story, good things happen to good people. And it's nice to finally see that in the UFC for once.
There's a lot to like about Dustin Poirier's story. I would say that the difference between – we talk about getting the Nate Diaz rub. The difference between Nate Diaz and Dustin Poirier is if you watch fights with your family, let's say, right? At the end of the Conor McGregor-Nate Diaz fight, maybe your cousin or your kind of sketchy uncle is like, now I'm a Nate Diaz fan. I know this guy. Well, I like this guy. You know, your uncle that, you know, maybe did a bid, maybe used to bust into cars when he was a kid. He likes Nate Diaz now, right? I think last night – you know, your wife's sister likes Dustin Poirier. Your mom likes Dustin Poirier. So I think Dustin Poirier is going to be able to transition this Conor McGregor thing into a lot of different directions. You know,
Ryan Garcia?
He could be. And I gave you a nice piece of – I gave the UFC a nice piece of advice earlier. I'm going to give him another one. Here's what you do with Dustin Poirier. And this is your first venture into this. Fight Pass, reality show, Poirier's family.
Oh,
that's wow. What you released the first season on YouTube, second season's on Fight Pass. There you go. All right.
Franklin out here just changing the world one podcast at a time. I love it.
All right. Let's go to the notebook dump. I got a couple things to talk about here. First of all, and I think we talked about this last time, but let's hit it again. I can't stand these graphics when these guys are walking out. The Iron Michael Chan with the shield, and this guy's got hit. Oh my God.
I like it.
Brutal.
This is my argument, though. This is my only argument against that. I understand it's cheesy. A lot of people might not like it, but please hear me out. How long did it take for the UFC to try anything new on the broadcast? Like, it's been years and years and years. Not every single new thing that they do is going to hit, but it's nice to see them try something new. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm with you. And maybe it's like a nod or a wink to like the UFC video game. I can see a little bit where their graphics look like they could be in video games. All right, I'll give you that. Next, were you surprised that they mentioned Bellator on the broadcast?
I was so happy they did. Okay, because you know they do the same thing. If you're a KSW world champ, if you're any of the larger promotions, KSW, Bellator, ONE, Ryzen, they always refer to those as he was a champion in another organization.
Outside of the UFC. Yeah,
outside of the UFC. It was really nice that they actually did talk about Bellator. And again, this might be a conversation for another thing. Maybe the UFC is more open to cross promotion now than they ever were before. Just an idea.
Maybe. I think they thought Chandler might lose. And they were like, let's put Bellator out there and then watch this kid get beat up. Now, side note. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Side note to that, smart move by Bellator to show Michael Chandler fights this week on their YouTube channels.
Yeah, they're like, oh, wow, our boy's gone. That's a great thing to do if you're Bellator. And I saw Patricio Pitbull. He was like, oh, wow, like now you know there are good guys outside the UFC. That was a conversation that was all over Twitter. And I heard Luke Thomas say this, so I'm going to say the exact same thing. Michael Chandler winning doesn't change anything over in Bellator. I'm sorry, but it really doesn't. Like, the people who watch Bellator are already watching Bellator. And the people who are going to cross over, like, they just realize, oh, he graduated from Bellator now. Like, that's the way a lot of people are going to see this fight, I think. So it's nice that Bellator is trying to associate themselves with Michael Chandler. They're in the Michael Chandler business, if you will. But I don't know if this is going to bring as many eyes over to Bellator as Bellator thinks it will.
Well, it's weird because – so I do, you know, podcasts. I've done podcasts for a while. I've written, you know – so I'm deep in the MMA game. The only thing that's ever drawn me to a promotion is guys who are fighting in that promotion. Never somebody that left or that, – that's just not me. Like, when Conor left Cage Warriors – I didn't start watching Cage Warriors. I'd watch Cage Warriors if a guy on Cage Warriors was knocking people out. I watch Bellator if Michael Page is knocking people dead, not because Eddie Alvarez left and now I'm going to watch him. The guy that was worth watching has now left. So how is that? So how is that a thing that, like, this whole thing that they think people are going to tune in to see the next Michael Chandler? That's not how people work. They want to see what you got now. Let's talk about the announced team. Anik Felder, DC. What do you think?
I really liked it. Again, you had said this in one of our earlier podcasts, and I just love the quote. Dana Cormier is like the friend you just don't got to worry about. Like, you know, you got some friends, and you got to ask, like, hey, is it cool if they come? DC works with everyone. Again, the only combo I don't really like is DC and Rogan, because maybe I just don't like Rogan, and just no matter what he does, I'm not
taking that on DC. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that is a little bit of it. And I can admit that right now, but I love Dana Cormier doing commentary. He's the perfect combination of, like, I know so much about this sport. It's not even funny, but also, like, I can kind of, like, let my guard down and have a good time, especially with the other guys, John Anik, Paul Felder. It's a great trio. You always like those guys together.
The thing I give DC is that doesn't get talked about a lot. Is not only does he know the fighters that are the fights that are happening, he has real relationships with the guys that he does commentary with. So in the middle of a fight, somebody will do something and he'll say something like, that looks like Paul Felder in there. You know, like a guy will go to the, you know, slugging it out or anything that Paul Felder is. He's throwing kicks like Paul Felder. Like, he knows who he's with. He knows the things Rogan said and can reference them. That's what I think is DC's real, like, superpower when it comes to being a commentator. All right. I mean, this is pretty much it. Listen, we get a little bit of a break as the UFC moves operations back to the fight capital of the world, Las Vegas. The next UFC will be Saturday, February 6th. It's Alexander Overeem and Alexander Volkov. Alistair Overeem and Alexander Volkov. You know, it's been a long podcast. We don't have to worry about that fight. We'll get to that. I'm going to see you guys do previews. What do you got going on yourself between now and then on the channel? What are you gonna keep yourself busy?
So Craig and I might have a certain weekly MMA show coming out next week to fill some of the time. And also we're going to be covering an organization that is not the UFC. It's one that Craig and I really enjoy. I'll give you guys a little hint. There's a lot of UFC fighters from that area in the world. Maybe Jan Blachowicz fought for them at some point. So yeah, we still got a lot of MMA content coming out this week. And it's just, it's been a wild week for MMA. It's just, it's nice that, I don't know, maybe just because MMA's felt like such a niche sport and it's been outside of the mainstream for so long, it's really nice when you do get one of these big Conor McGregor cards and it just kind of reinforces, not your love for the sport, but you just kind of realize that like, wow, this sport isn't just like, you know, the weird kids from high school watch it. Like, this is a big sport now and it is starting to gain a lot more mainstream momentum.
It's different when Conor fights. It is. It'll always be different when Conor fights. Hopefully, my hope for fights like tonight are that a guy like Dustin Poirier can take a little bit of Conor's shine. And, you know, Conor is the notorious Conor McGregor for a reason, for better or worse. You know, he's a guy with sexual assault allegations and drug rumors. And he's also a guy who gives $500,000 to, you know, Dustin Poirier's charity. He's both guys. And he's our better angels and he's our worse angels. So,
one last point that I just thought of. I meant to bring this up earlier. If I'm Dustin Poirier, I trademark pressure makes diamonds, just like Kobe Bryant trademarked the Mamba mentality. Like, that's all I would say constantly. Like, Kobe Bryant was the Black Mamba. And then it was, I've got Mamba mentality. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. I'm just so mentally focused and prepared that I could beat anything. If I'm Dustin Poirier, you're kind of exemplify what your nickname is. Like, pressure makes diamonds. You could get knocked down. You can come back. And it's just going to make you better over time. If I'm him, I really start using that slogan all the time.
Yeah, I agree. There's something there. It's almost, I mean, I like what you said, but there's almost like it has to be like what Embrace the Grind was for a minute there with DC. Pressure makes diamonds. I like that. Maybe diamond pressure. There's something there where you could just, that's his thing. And then everybody like accepts that and starts to put the, put that in their hashtags and whatnot. All right, guys, there you have it. It's one more in the win column. One more for the highlight reel. One more for Fight Night Picks. Peace.